From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of America's greatest and most enduring cabaret singers, Blossom Deary. We'll talk with her and listen back to some of her recordings from the 50s that have been reissued. Also, the actor and playwright who's been described as our cowboy laureate, Sam Shepard. He won a 1979 Pulitzer Prize for his play, Buried Child. He wrote the screenplay for Paris, Texas, and starred in the films Days of Heaven, The Right Stuff, Country, Defenseless, and The Pelican Brief. He stars opposite Diane Keaton in the new movie, The Only Thrill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Former New York Congresswoman Bella Abzug has died at the age of 77 from complications following heart surgery. The raspy-voiced, hat-wearing feminist gained national prominence for her advocacy of civil rights and her opposition to the Vietnam War. Abzug was the first Jewish woman ever to be elected to Congress. President Clinton is pledging new measures to help Africa protect its environment. He spoke in Botswana today after meeting with environmentalists from around the continent.
Africans and Americans swim and fish in the same Atlantic Ocean, breathe the same air, suffer the same health risks from toxic chemicals, greenhouse gases, destruction of the ozone layer. If animal and plant species are lost, we are all diminished, even if they are lost on someone else's continent.
Mr. Clinton announced that NASA will soon begin a satellite survey of Africa to measure the impact of climate change on the environment there. A government report charges that the Federal Aviation Administration frequently allows airlines to get away with safety or security violations. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Interviews with several hundred FAA inspectors revealed that many never even bothered to report some of the safety problems they discover. The FAA has about 3,000 inspectors who were supposed to oversee the nation's airlines. But the General Accounting Office says inspectors are discouraged because their bosses frequently fail to punish airlines for safety or security lapses that do turn up. The Federal Aviation Administration has yet to respond to this report. The agency has said in the past that it wants to improve safety by cooperating with airlines instead of constantly punishing them. Some critics outside and inside the FAA say that means the agency has become too close to the industry it regulates. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
The Major League Baseball season begins today when the Mets host the Phillies in the first game of opening day. 11 games scheduled, including baseball's two newcomers, as NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
For the first time since 1993, baseball has expanded. There are now 30 teams with the addition of the Arizona Diamondbacks in the National League and the Tampa Bay Devil Rays in the American. Arizona appears to have more of a let's win now philosophy. The Diamondbacks signed several veteran free agents to huge multi-million dollar contracts. The Devil Rays signed well-known veterans Wade Boggs and Fred McGriff, but most of their money and time is devoted to long-term player development. Both teams are acutely aware of what happened with the last expansion. The Florida Marlins, one of two new teams in 1993, took just 5 years to win a World Series title, but the Marlins spent heavily on free agents and this offseason had to get rid of many of them to save money. Today in Miami, a Marlins team with many new and cheaper players hosts the Chicago Cubs. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Miami.
And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now up 100 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market is advancing with the Dow higher for the first time in five sessions and the Nasdaq in record territory. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner has more.
The market is being boosted by a drop in long-term interest rates, which follows some weaker-than-expected economic news. Consumer confidence slipped from a 29-year high in March. And while the report on regional manufacturing in the Midwest showed growth was strong during March, prices are being contained by the effects of the Asian financial crisis. The market is also benefiting from optimism about low inflation as the result of falling crude oil prices. Crude has lost 4% after OPEC cut production by less than expected at yesterday's emergency meeting. Investors are also betting that the Federal Reserve will leave interest rates unchanged at today's policy meeting. I'm Doug Krisner.
Motorola is reportedly planning to announce a major restructuring within the next several weeks. The Wall Street Journal says the electronics firm is considering merging a half dozen business divisions into two major segments, one for consumer-oriented products, the other for industrial customers. Any such change could affect thousands of jobs. Gibson Greetings Incorporated says it will cut nearly 500 jobs, or about 7% of its workforce, in a major restructuring aimed at lowering cost and improving customer service. The greeting card firm says it will outsource all of its card, gift wrap, and other manufacturing operations at its suburban Cincinnati headquarters by the end of this year. Toyota is planning to add about 1,000 jobs to its truck assembly plant in Princeton, Indiana. The Japanese automaker says it will invest $500 million to expand the capacity of the plant by about a third. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of us who love American popular song love Blossom Dearie because she finds such interesting songs to sing and does them so well. Back in 1974, New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot placed her alongside Bobby Short and Mabel Mercer as one of the consummate triumvirate of supper club singers that rule the upper regions of American popular song. New York Times music critic Stephen Holden wrote, "Her exquisite conversational phrasing gives her material the aura and rhythm of short stories." Several of Blossom Dearie's Verve recordings from the 50s and early 60s have been reissued. Before we meet her, let's hear one of the obscure but wonderful songs in her repertoire, a good song for the new season. It's called "They Say It's Spring," recorded in 1957.
They say it's spring. This feeling light as a feather. They say this thing, this magic we share together, came with the weather too. They say it's May that's made me daft as a daisy. It's May, they say, that gave the whole world this crazy, heavenly, hazy hue. I'm a lark on the wing, I'm the spark of a firefly's fling. Yet to me, this must be something more than a seasonal thing. Could it be spring? Those bells that I can hear ringing, it may be spring. But when the robin stops singing, you're what I'm clinging to. Though they say it's spring, it's you.
Blossom Dearie, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
You find such great songs to sing. I'm interested in the story of how you found that one, "They Say It's Spring."
Marty Clark wrote the music to "They Say It's Spring," and Bob Hames wrote the words. And they came to me, both of them. I met them somehow back in those days, and they played a couple of songs for me. And I love that one in particular.
Now, you have a very small voice when you sing.
Yes, I do have a small voice, yes.
Did you ever try to make that into a big voice?
Oh, into a big voice. I have taken voice lessons a couple of times from legitimate voice teachers. In fact, I'm going back to a teacher now. Once in a while, once every 10 years, I go to a voice teacher, and we work on my voice a little bit, but they all say the same thing, that they tell me I'm not breathing properly. And it's very funny to have worked and sung for so many years, and then someone say to you, well, you're not breathing properly. Also, I do turn to the side, to the right when I sing, and they say that that constricts the vocal cords.
Oh, because you're sitting at the piano and you're turning to face
down,
the audience.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's mostly the breathing that they are concerned about. They say you have to breathe right in this diaphragm and work on it. And I think that would probably make my voice more powerful. But at this age, I don't think I'm going to worry about it. And I have never been a singer who could stand up and sing like a theatrical singer. I just, I sit down, and I've always used a microphone. I have a kind of microphone technique.
Now, I think because you have a very unique voice that you often rethink songs, though maybe that's just your unique sensibility. But, I mean, I love you for the obscure songs that you find and sing, but also when you do a standard, it often sounds very different than
Thank
the ways
you.
I've heard it done before. And I think an excellent example of that is your version of Surrey with a Fringe on Top.
I was just going to say that.
Good.
And I've had so many requests for Surrey with a Fringe on Top that I'm doing it again after many years.
Oh, good. See, most mm-hmm. singers, I think, do this at a kind of clip-clop type of pace, and you slow it down to a ballad.
I slowed it down.
It's really lovely.
And, when I first heard the song sung in the Broadway show, I didn't like the interpretation at all.
Me neither.
But I liked the song.
Mm-hmm.
And I could sort of relate to that, being from the country, and the horse and the buggy, which is something I always liked. And so I just slowed it down to give the words more meaning. And same thing with Tea for Two. I slowed that way down. And Manhattan.
Well, why don't I play Surrey with a Fringe on Top from one of those Verve reissues?
All right.
Chicks and ducks and geese better scurry when I take you out in the Surrey. When I take you out in the Surrey with the fringe on top. Watch that fringe and see how it flutters when I drive them high steppin' strutters. Nosy pokes'll peek through the shutters and their eyes will pop. The wheels are yellow, the upholstery's brown, the dashboard's genuine leather. With eyes and glass curtains you can roll right down in case there's a change in the weather. Two bright side lights winking and blinking, ain't no finer rig I'm a thinking. You can keep your rig if you're thinking that I'd care to swap for that shiny little Surrey with a fringe on the top.
That's Blossom Dearie, recorded in 1958 from one of the records reissued on the Verve label. Blossom Dearie, you were born in New York in a town in the Catskill Mountains. Was that a resort town?
Yes and no. A little country village in the upstate New York. I feel like a real New Yorker because I was born upstate, and I live in New York City, so New York State is my state.
I know your father was a bartender and I think a hotel manager.
Uh-huh.
Now, did he ever work with singers at the bar?
No.
Not that kind of bar,
no.
Huh?
But my father was very musical,
mm-hmm.
and he used to sing around the house. And he sang good songs, and my mother liked good songs, too, so I grew up in an atmosphere of good songs. My daddy used to whistle and sing a lot of popular songs at the time.
Were you pretty uninhibited as a child when it came to singing?
No, I didn't sing as a child. That came later when I came to New York. I was playing piano as a child, and then when I came to New York City, I started singing. The piano came first. I think of myself more as a musician than just a singer. I think it's the musicianship that people like about my work.
Now, I know when you moved to New York, you became friends with Gil Evans, the arranger who, among other things, arranged the Miles Davis records Birth of the Cool and Porgy and Bess. You met Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. What was the impact of bebop on you? So many musicians were absolutely taken by bebop, and you are much more involved with standards and, you know, with a much more melodic style than bebop. So I'm wondering about the impact of that on you.
The impact of bebop was a great impact on me, and I knew those musicians and loved them very much. I heard Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, and then eventually I worked at the Village Vanguard opposite Miles Davis, and that was one of the highlights of my career, I think, working at the Vanguard opposite Miles Davis in that group. That was just tremendous. I loved it very much. I never was a bebop singer, but I listened to the choruses the choruses that everybody did, and the improvising.
Now, Miles is a musician who I think always loved songs. He recorded
a lot of
songs on his records, and I know he liked a lot of singers. Did you trade song ideas with each other?
Yes, we did. We were very friendly. He used to come to hear me a lot, and I used to go to hear him a lot. We belonged to a kind of a social circle, and we'd meet at parties and things like that. And he liked Surrey with the Fringe on Top, as a matter of fact.
Oh, no kidding. Did he like your version of it, or he liked it before?
Yes, he did.
And
we were very friendly, and then he finally arranged for me to work opposite him at the Village Vanguard on five different occasions. That was in the early 60s, and that was very memorable.
My guest is Blossom Dearie. What do you do when you're learning a song? Do you feel like you need to know it by heart? Would you go up with sheet music for a performance?
No, not sheet music. I have to learn the music first. Mm-hmm. I have to learn to play the song, get it in the right key, and I learn the song at the piano. But I have lyrics on the piano which are hidden. You know, the piano part is just about all I can handle for the beginning of the song. Then I sort of refer to the lyrics now and then.
Why do you feel you need to hide the lyrics when you're referring to them?
Well, I don't want them shown. It doesn't look very nice, I don't think.
And do you usually need to refer to them, or do you usually actually really
know
them?
New songs, I do until I learn them.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on the lyrics. If there's a story involved, it's easier to memorize the lyrics than just impressions and things like Peel Me a Grape. Well, I guess it took me a long time to learn that because there's no story. There's no continuity. I mean, it's just one thing after another. A love song is easier to memorize.
Why is that?
Because of the continuity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it just has images, then you just sort of have to memorize it.
Well, Blossom Dearie, thank you so much for talking
with
us. Blossom Dearie, she's performing through the end of April at Danny's Skylight Room in Manhattan. Let's listen to another recording from the late 50s, reissued by Verve. This is I Won't Dance.
I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, monsieur, with you. My heart won't let my feet do things they should do. You know what? You're handsome. You know what? Too handsome. But oh, what you do to me. I'm like an ocean wave that's bumped on the shore. I feel so absolutely stumped on the floor. When you dance, you're charming and you're gentle. Especially when you do the continental. But this feeling isn't purely mental. For heaven rest us, I'm not asbestos. And that's why I won't dance. Why should I won't dance.
This is Fresh Air. Spring is here, and what do you know, it's brought a public radio fundraiser. Spring is a time of renewal. Yes, and what better time to ask you to renew your membership or become a new member. Make that pledge. Here's how. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Atlantic Records, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, is best known as the home of some of the greatest soul music ever waxed. This was a logical development for the company, which had always been in the forefront of black popular music. In the second part of our series on Atlantic, rock historian Ed Ward shows us how it happened.
With the arrival of Jerry Wexler and the signing of Ray Charles in the early 50s, Atlantic Records entered its classic period. With founder Ahmet Erdogan developing his songwriting skills, engineer Tom Dowd being able to make even the funkiest studio sound good, and a genuine commitment on all sides to good music, the label was far more streamlined than the average R&B indie of the period. Ray Charles was unique. A blues singer heavily influenced by gospel, he was struggling to find his own style when the label signed him, but when he found it, it was something new.
Well, I got a woman way over town that's good to me. Oh, yeah. Say, I got a woman way over town good to me. Oh, yeah. She give me money when I'm in need. Yeah, she's a kind of friend indeed. I got a woman way over town.
Wexler, who had already coined the term rhythm and blues while at Billboard magazine, heard this and called it soul, a term he'd often heard jazz musicians use. Soul music, of course, wasn't born at Atlantic, but the label was a powerful midwife. Part of this was due to the fact that as the 50s moved on, Atlantic was smart enough to sign deals not only with performers, but with producers. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller had written Hound Dog as teenagers and had their fingers on the pulse of the new rock and roll sound. They'd been working with an L.A. group called the Robins, and when Atlantic convinced the group and their producers to move to New York, they were rechristened the Coasters.
Take out the papers and the trash, or you don't get no spending cash. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor, you ain't gonna rock and roll no more. Yakety-yak!
Don't go back.
Just finish cleaning up your room.
Songs like Yakety Yak struck a chord with black and white teens and made the Coasters one of the most successful acts on the label. The Yakety Sax on the record was played by King Curtis, who would become a mainstay of the label's studio sound over the next decade. Lieber and Stoller were also assigned to work with the Drifters, who'd completely changed personnel since the early days, and called on their young L.A. colleague Phil Spector to help with songwriting chores once the Drifters' lead singer, Benny King, spun off onto a solo career.
There is a rose in Spanish Harlem. A red rose up in Spanish Harlem. It is a special one. It's never seen the sun. It only comes up when the moon is on the run and all the stars are gleaming.
Spanish Harlem, co-written by Spector in 1960, was an early landmark of soul, from its Black Pride lyrics to King's vocal. Another producer they'd worked closely with was Burt Burns, who had come to them with a young preacher from Philadelphia, who had become another important early soul figure.
When your baby leaves you all alone, and nobody calls you on the phone, don't you feel like a cry? Don't you feel like crying? Well, here I am, honey. Come on, you cry to me. When you're all alone.
Solomon Burke's Cry to Me was a typical meticulous Atlantic recording session featuring top flight jazz men like Hank Jones and Bucky Pizzarelli, and an arrangement by Klaus Ogerman, who worked with Frank Sinatra, and it paid off in sales. The jazz connection wasn't just Atlantic showing off. Nessie Erdogan, one of the label's founders, remained committed to jazz, and while his brother and Jerry Wexler mined the pop end of the black music of the time, Nessie signed deals with some of the most progressive jazz musicians, like the Modern Jazz Quartet, John Coltrane, Charles Mingus, and Ornette Coleman, all of whom made important records for the label. But the money was in soul, and Wexler was smart enough to know there was just so much you could do in the North. He carefully monitored the Southern retail situation and offered Atlantic's national distribution clout to Stax Records, a small label that had formed in Memphis in 1959. Before long, Atlantic was sending its own artists to Stax to record with their phenomenal house band, and the results were astounding.
I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling.
Wilson Pickett's In the Midnight Hour was co-written by Pickett and Stax guitarist Steve Cropper and established Pickett's career. Wexler also had his eye on a young vocalist who he felt was being straitjacketed into recording pop jazz records, a woman he'd first noticed when she was a young teenager recording gospel. When Aretha Franklin's contract with the Columbia Records was up, Wexler moved fast to get her for Atlantic and, working with Tom Dowd and the best musicians he could find, turned her into Lady Soul. In the latter half of the 60s, Atlantic was the powerhouse of soul. But the Black Pride movement soul helped fuel had another side, and it blew up in Jerry Wexler's face at a black radio convention in 1968, where he found himself reviled as a white man exploiting black talent and burned in effigy. Atlantic kept recording soul, but clearly it was time to start looking elsewhere.
Ed Ward is Fresh Air's rock historian. He currently lives in Berlin. Tomorrow, in his Atlantic series, he looks at the label's move into rock music. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, playwright and actor Sam Shepard talks about his fear of flying, a surprising fear for the actor who played test pilot Chuck Yeager in The Right Stuff. Shepard is now starring with Diane Keaton in the new movie The Only Thrill.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of David Halberstam's History of the Civil Rights Movement, The Children.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sam Shepard's acting has been described as iconic. He's also a playwright who was described in Esquire as creating quintessential American characters in the idioms of rock, sci-fi, dope, and the Wild West. Shepard starred in The Right Stuff, Crimes of the Heart, Steel Magnolias, Days of Heaven, Country, Voyager, Defenseless, and The Pelican Brief. He wrote the screenplay for Paris, Texas. His plays include Fool for Love, True West, and Buried Child, which won a Pulitzer in 1979. His latest play, Eyes for Consuela, is concluding its off-Broadway run. And he's starring in the new movie, The Only Thrill, which also stars Diane Keaton. One of the subjects Sam Shepard has written about is his fear of flying, which not only goes against his iconic image, it's a contrast to his portrayal of test pilot Chuck Yeager in The Right Stuff.
I got to meet Chuck Yeager, you know, when I was shooting The Right Stuff. And he's a man who's known for impeccable courage and all the rest of it. And I got to talking to him about flying and all that. And he says, it's not true that you don't have fear. You know, fear is part and parcel of the thing that you take on. It's that you're able to face it, you know. To me, that's the interesting part about courage, you know. It's not that you don't have fear, it's that you look it in the eye, you know.
But Chuck Yeager went on to be, a famous test pilot. You played him in The Right Stuff, but you don't go up in planes yourself, right?
I do occasionally, yeah. I'm getting better at it, actually. I go to Mexico once a year and stuff like that. It's just that I'm not crazy about it, you know, and it's a funny thing because I grew up in a kind of rural situation, and most of the people that I've talked to from that kind of background are terrified of flying, and I always thought that was curious, you know, the people who had a background of being sort of stuck in the land don't like to get up in airplanes, and I don't know if that's just a coincidence or you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I have a farmer friend of mine who once a year flies to Las Vegas to have a go at the one-armed bandits, and he can't stand airplanes. He hates them. But he goes, you know?
Now, did playing Chuck Yeager have any effect on you and flying?
Any effect on me and flying? No, I went up with him actually once in a little Piper Cub over the desert. Because I thought, you know, if I'm going to crash, I might as well go down with the world's greatest pilot. So we went to this hangar, and he took this little hook that was like looked like an umbrella handle and pulled this airplane out of the hangar by hand. And it was a single prop plane. We jumped in the damn thing and took off, and I couldn't believe it. I felt great. It was a great feeling. We kind of hovered over the desert, and he showed me different stuff, you know, where he hung out in his Air Force days. And that was fun.
Now, I know your father was a bomber pilot in World War II. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that had any impact on you. And if you
I'm sure it did.
Did you hear a lot of scary stories about nearly being shot down during the war?
Well, he had quite a few scrapes. He had a bunch of shrapnel hit him and stuff. And one time they had a belly gunner, you know, in those old big planes. They had these glass turrets underneath the fuselage with the machine gun turret, and one of his buddies was in that while he was flying the bomber, and the turret got shot off, and he saw his pal go down, you know, stuff like that. I don't know. I guess it gives you a little nightmares when you're a kid and stuff. I suppose it does. It has affected me, but I'm not sure how.
What effect do you think it has on your career? You know, a lot of people, especially those who don't live in L.A.
The fear of flying in my career?
Yeah, because...
Is that what you're...
Yeah, because, you know, if you're an actor and you don't live in L.A., well, you know, you fly there when you get the part.
Oh,
but if you
I
don't
see.
Like
I
to fly, it's really a burden to get there, yeah. Particularly on short notice or to go back and forth. You know, a lot of people like bi-coastal, always flying
right.
back and forth between New York and L.A. You've got plays mm-hmm. in New York and mm-hmm. movie jobs in L.A. And
yeah, it slows things down, but I enjoy driving. In fact, I just drove to British Columbia to do a film and got stuck in that big blizzard in South Dakota coming back. But it was kind of neat. You know, I stayed 2 days in Wyoming and Sheridan and Gillette, you know, while the winds were blowing 50 miles an hour, and it was kind of interesting.
Sam Shepard is my guest, and he's starring in a new movie, which is called The Only Thrill. He also has a new play that's now off-Broadway in Manhattan, and that's called Eyes for Consuela. Now, some of your plays have dealt with family upheaval, family violence. You left your family as a teenager. You left home.
I did. I was driven out.
driven out by your parents?
Well, that's unfair to say. I mean, I left in a kind of holocaust of my old man. You know, he destroyed the house, and I decided it was time to go.
What did your father do that destroyed the house?
What did he do?
Yeah.
Broke windows, tore the doors off, stuff like that.
Oh, literally destroyed the house?
Yeah, physically.
Huh. How did your mother handle that? She didn't run away with you.
She's a very brave soul.
Was your father very strict when you were growing up? Were there a lot of rules you were supposed to follow? What were the rules?
He was an Air Force guy, you know.
Right.
Crew cut, and all that stuff.
So what were the rules you were supposed to obey as a kid?
What were the rules I was supposed to obey? Never show any feeling was one of the rules.
Well, that's interesting. Let me stop you there, because in several of your roles, you're a character who doesn't show his feelings. Even in the new movie, it's clear how much he feels for the Diane Keaton character, but he's kind of, in her eyes, unwilling to demonstrate it enough.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to escape your background, you know, and I don't think it's necessary to even try, you know, to escape it. More and more, I start to think that it's necessary to see exactly what it is that you inherited on both ends of the stick. Your timidity, your courage, your self-deceit, and your honesty, and all the rest of it. You know, it's necessary to include all of that in order to be able to accept oneself. Because you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the characters that I portray have to do with that kind of dilemma is fine by me, because I know what that is, you know. And I suppose the way it's expressed is part and parcel of who I am. I can't get away from it, you know.
Now, I think there's a kind of hard-boiled quality about some of your characters, so that even if they don't kind of openly express a lot of emotion, they're also... they're vulnerable, but in a hard-boiled way, as opposed to in a way where they don't express emotion, but, you know, behind closed doors they'd be crying or something. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you thought of yourself as having that hard-boiled quality when you were still in the house with your parents, kind of in a house ruled by your father.
No, I never, as a kid, thought of myself as hard-boiled. That came later.
Mm-hmm.
Under the influence of my old man and the family situation and all that, I never for a second believed that I was that tough, you know? You can't, as a child, you don't think of yourself as tough. I mean, you may be able to bear certain things, but I just never had that kind of image of myself as a tough kid.
When your father was tearing doors off hinges and breaking windows, was he beating you up too?
Now and then, you know. Yeah. But I mean, I wouldn't say that I had a particularly horrendous childhood compared to the modern kids. You know, I think the modern kids probably have it worse, you know, having sometimes no fatherly influence at all, you know.
My guest is playwright and actor Sam Shepard. He's starring with Diane Keaton in the new movie, The Only Thrill. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is playwright and actor Sam Shepard. When you were young, did you find any resonance in books or movies, you know, with the situation that you were in? Did you gravitate to books or movies that seemed to describe family similar to yours? Or did you look for something completely different in books and movies?
Well, no, I was... It was funny, when I was in high school, again, we were out in the middle of the boondocks, you know, and there was a little bitty art house theater, I remember, out in a place called Cucamonga.
Oh, wow, and, you really lived in a place called near Cucamonga?
Yeah.
Remember on the Jack Benny show? It was always, the bus announcer was always saying, in Cucamonga.
Yeah, it really is a Cucamonga. It was surrounded by vineyards, you know, and for some reason, it was this little bitty art house theater, and they'd show foreign films, which was just unbelievable in those days, because there wasn't anything around but Ben-Hur and, you know, Cleopatra and all those kind of things. So me and a couple of buddies of mine would go out there, and I saw a film called 400 Blows by Truffaut, black and white film. And that really stunned me, you know. It was like, wow, you know, this kid, I saw a lot of similarities in that, between my situation and that, you know.
He sent to reform school in that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he had a pretty rough deal.
So you were seeing art films in Cucamonga, wow.
Yeah, art films, imagine that.
So were you seeing plays or reading plays?
No. Uh-uh. I'd read some O'Neill.
Talk about family drama.
Yeah, some of his one-act stuff. And then I saw the film based on Long Day's Journey into Night, which I thought was an amazing film. You know, particularly since it was based on a play. I don't think most plays make good movies, but in that case, it was incredible performances. You know.
You started off acting in, I think it was a repertory company, a small repertory company that basically toured churches.
Yeah, when I first left home, I got this paper route. And I was delivering papers all over. I had a 51 Chevy, and I was throwing papers all around the houses and stuff. And at the end of the day, I started going through this paper, and at the end of it, in the work section, there was this little ad that said, "Actors Wanted." And I went in and auditioned for this company. It was called the Bishop's Company. And the great thing about it was a traveling company. It was going to get the hell out of there, you know. So they hired me, and the next day I was on a Greyhound bus to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and joined up with the company there, and we toured all over the place and did these one-night stands in churches, which was my first real experience with theater.
It's funny because you went, you know, from churches eventually to off-Broadway at a time when off-Broadway was, you know, very avant-garde for its time, so it's an interesting contrast. Playing the church circuit must have been an interesting way to see the country and get started acting.
Yeah, and also to see this, probably the last of that kind of 50s culture, although it was the 60s, you know, there's still a 50s feel about it, you know, that culture in small town America. It was pretty amazing.
So you went to New York, I think it was in 1963?
Yeah.
What was it like to be, I think you were living or at least working in Greenwich Village. Was this your first exposure to an avant-garde and to a bohemian life, to a life that was radically different from the kind of military life that you grew up in, and also radically different from the churches that you were touring?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. I was suddenly on the Lower East Side on Avenue C and 10th Street living with jazz musicians.
Well, I think your roommate was Charles Mingus's son.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd gone to high school with him, and he was working at a place called the Village Gate, and got me a job there as a busboy. So that's how I got initiated into New York.
Were you a good busboy?
Oh, yeah, excellent. I got fired, though, because I knocked over a candle on a guy's suit. And that was the end of that job.
Right, right.
But in the course of that, I got to see probably the most amazing musicians of their time, you know, like the Adderley Brothers and Mingus and Thelonious Monk and Jerry Mulligan. It was just a free show, you know.
Yeah, because the Village Gate was a club.
Yeah, yep.
Actor and playwright Sam Shepard is my guest, and he has a new off-Broadway show called Eyes for Consuela, and he's starring with Diane Keaton in the new movie, The Only Thrill. In the 60s, everybody wrote about you as, like, the new bright hope of off-Broadway. What was off-Broadway like when you started writing plays for off-Broadway?
Well, obviously, it was so poverty-stricken that they had to pick on me. Now, I don't really know anything about off-Broadway at that time because I didn't try to, you know, it was commercial in its own way as Broadway was. You know, it was as forbidding as Broadway as far as opening the door to it. And I just was lucky in the fact that all of these little cafes and churches and stuff were starting to open up to, a brand new way of theater.
Did you want to act in your own plays? Did you see that as
No.
a possibility for yourself? Why not?
I don't know. It seems like the height of vanity to me, you know, acting and writing and direct. You know what I mean? It's embarrassing.
And that's what kept you from doing it, thinking I was vain?
Yeah, in some ways, I suppose. Of course, that's kind of vain, too, to think that. But, it was just... And the other side of it, too, is that I kind of like seeing the writing from the outside. I like seeing an actor play it.
Uh-huh.
Where I don't think you can really see the writing if you're inside it.
Do you, when you're writing lines for a play, do you speak the lines out loud to just hear how they sound
sometimes.
Spoken?
Sometimes, yeah.
Now, when you're writing dialogue for a play, do you ever hear a certain musicality in a line, like where you hear the accent, where you hear the emphasis is being, and then the actor does it completely differently than that. And
oh yeah,
and maybe it works, but maybe it doesn't work for you. Maybe you feel like your intention was kind of lost. Will you say something to the actor about that if you do feel that the music you're hearing is lost?
Well, yeah, but I think more often, particularly if you have good actors like, for instance, Malkovich and Ed Harris and Jim Gammon and these great actors that I've had the good fortune to get, they often will land things in an unexpected way that's not only surprising but right. You know, I mean, much more right than you could have intended. You know, in other words, they bring the intention of the writing into another dimension, in another domain. Malkovich has an uncanny ability to do that.
Any general impressions about most screenplays that you read now about how well they're written?
Oh boy. Well, my main problem with screenplays nowadays, you know, that most of the ones I've seen is that there are no characters whatsoever in them. That's my main problem. You just don't find any characters. You find these formulas.
Uh-huh.
You find these sort of Hollywood rituals going on, but you don't find characters. Every once in a while you do. I mean, I don't want to be too harsh. Like this snow falling on cedars that I'm doing in Vancouver. It has very clear characters in it, actual human beings in it. But many, many of the characters don't even feel human. They feel computerized or faxed or, you know, somebody's mailed it in. And they all kind of sound like the same. They come from the same person. I don't know if it's a secretary out there who's doing it or what.
That's the secret.
Very weird, you know.
You must be able to read screenplays with confidence because you write plays. I mean, I know, like for me, for instance, it's very hard for me to read a play or a screenplay and really be able to kind of stage in my mind how it would look and sound together.
Well, screenplays are easier to read because if you can't get past the first five pages, you might as well throw it in the fire, you know? That's it. Five pages.
Well, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your life and your work. Appreciate it very much.
You bet.
Sam Shepard is starring in the new film, The Only Thrill. This is Fresh Air. I want to remind you of something that you probably already know but may not yet have acted on. Public radio relies on listener support to keep it going. This alternative way of funding is what enables us to bring you programming that you enjoy, but that might not be profitable enough for a commercial station to bother with. So please call with a pledge to keep public radio going. Thank you. From Seinfeld to chatty TV news anchors to all talk radio, we're constantly surrounded by banter. And according to our linguist Jeff Nunberg, that could be one reason for the current popularity of email.
The dawn of theater, they say, was when the Greek chorus split into two groups who alternated speaking. One sings, "Woe, woe for the frenzy of Ajax," and the other sings, "A terrible business, terrible." The Greeks had a word for this, stichomythia, which means roughly speaking in turns. It isn't a word I've generally had a lot of use for over the years, apart from a brief turn or two just after the movie Mighty Aphrodite came out. But I find it coming to mind a lot these days whenever a new batch of email is dumped over my transom. This all began with a feature that email systems describe as include message in reply. You tell the mailer to reply to a message, and it gives you a window that contains the original message indented or set off with carrots on the left margin so that you can insert your responses or comments wherever appropriate. The feature does have its downside, particularly when people don't keep a judicious pinky on the delete key. X sends a long inquiry to Y, and Y adds some remarks and forwards it to Z, and Z adds his comments and forwards it to you, each of them including all the previous messages in successively deeper rows of carrots along the left margin. When you're reading the thing and trying to find the part of the message that's intended for you, it can feel like eating an artichoke. But it's a small price to pay for the charms of the feature in personal mail, where you can repeat a snippet of your correspondent's message and interpolate your own remarks. A syntax ready-made for banter. The messages go back and forth with carrots and indentations piling up, and you and your correspondent come to feel you're making a little work of art together. It's what conversation would like to be if it only had a room of its own to repair to. It lets us all play Seinfeld writers with half an hour to figure out just what Jerry should snap back to George at the coffee shop. That's why the reply feature of email has been such a success. It was dropped into an age that was already obsessed with banter. You think of all those saucy radio DJs, the happy talk news programs, the political discussion shows where pundits snarl put-downs at each other. It's not an accident that the characteristic slang of the age consists almost entirely of a repertory of sardonic retorts. Whatever. I don't think so. Hello. In the end, email may be the most important literary form that we can hope for from electronic life. People keep waiting for the moment when our major literary genres will move to an electronic medium. Migrate is a word you hear a lot in this context, as in when the novel has migrated to the screen. It's not likely to happen that way, though. You encounter a traditional novel online, it feels like running into Alexander Solzhenitsyn in a 7-Eleven near his house in Vermont. And in any case, when new forms of art do emerge, they tend to grow out of the humdrum and marginal uses that a new medium is first put to. That's how the novel itself first got going, with its roots in popular genres like broadsides, newspaper stories, and above all, the personal letters that people started to exchange furiously as soon as the first public postal services appeared. Of course, email doesn't have to turn into anything grander for us to enjoy its modest virtues, the pleasures of merely circulating, as the poet called them. As forms of art go, it's probably no more than we deserve in an age where Howard Stern passes for a master of badinage. The most we can hope for from a technology is that it will give expression to the sensibilities that are already in the air, the way the novel gave voice to the 18th century bourgeois fascination with the language of private life. That's what gives email its stichomythic charm, is that it gives us a template for our raillery, the carrot and the shtick.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. This Friday, our Fresh Air Archive Edition will salute The Simpsons, which is celebrating its 200th episode, April 26th. We'll close with an excerpt from an episode which presented a musical comedy version of A Streetcar Named Desire set in The Simpsons' hometown of Springfield.
My name is Blanche Dubois. I thought my life would be a Mardi Gras, a never-ending party. Ha! I'm a faded Southern dame without a dime.
I'm collecting for the Evening Star.
Come here. I want to kiss you just once, softly and sweetly, on your mouth.
I am just a simple paper boy. No romance do I seek. I just wanted for decency for my deliveries last week. Will this bewitching floozy seduce this humble newsy? Oh, what's a paper boy to do?
Woo-hoo! Stella! Stella!
Can't you hear me, Ella? You put me through hell, Stella, Stella!
We'll salute The Simpsons this Friday on Fresh Air. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Tracy Tannenbaum with Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I have always depended on the kindness of strangers.
You can always depend on the kindness of strangers to walk up your spirit and shield from dangers.
Now here's a tip from Blanche you won't regret.
All strangers just a friend you have in there. You have in there.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, former poet laureate Robert Haas reads some of his favorite recent poems by other poets, poems collected in his new book, Poet's Choice, Poems for Everyday Life. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.